Welcome, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Giving Children Hope Internet Radio Show. I want to welcome everyone and also say hi to Stephen Roberts, our producer, who is here with us. Hi, Stephen. Thank you for producing this show tonight.
Hi, ladies. Donna, Tanis.
Hi. And
hi.
Tanis, my co-host in Canada.
Hi.
Hello, beautiful. Thank you for being here with us tonight.
Thank you.
We also have an incredibly special guest tonight. Tanis and I have barely been able to contain ourselves. We have Garland Waller on with us tonight. She is the infamous movie producer, documentary producer of No Way Out But One. Garland, we are extremely honored. Thank you for blessing us tonight and coming on the show with us.
Well, I am really delighted and honored to be here, and I want to thank you all for the work that you're doing in terms of getting the word out and keeping an organization like this going. I think this is really, really important work, so I'm delighted to be part of it.
Well, thank you. Garland, when we go to start a show, we have typically started each week where Tanis reads a scripture that may have jumped out to her just before the show, tonight. And then at the end of the show, we read another scripture. I'll read another scripture that had jumped out to me. So before we get into this too much, I kind of want to turn this over to Tanis. Just so she could read her scripture for tonight.
Sure. Well, a lovely passage from 1 John 3, 1 to 2, just jumped out at me. And it's a reminder of what this show is about for us and for the children and the young people we're trying to reach in particular. We are God's children. See what great love the Father has for us, that He would call us His children, and that is what we are. For this reason, the people of the world do not know who we are because they did not know Him. Dear friends, we are God's children now. And I'll just leave it at that. That's from 1 John 3.
Well, it's nice. Amen. Thank you so much, Tanis, for sharing that. I think that fits our show tonight perfectly, and we're going to have a great show. Garland, I'm so excited to have you with us. Would you, can we kind of start this a little just by sharing what No Way Out But One, a documentary, is? I want to kind of open this up to you.
Sure. Well, No Way Out But One is a documentary on the first American woman to be granted asylum by the Dutch government on grounds of domestic violence. After a family court judge in Minnesota gave custody of her children to a man who had fractured her son's skull, she was shocked and appalled and ultimately kidnapped her own children and ran in order to protect them. And her story is an extraordinary story of a mother who loved her children so much that she risked everything. She left home and friends and comfort to go on the run. They ran to Canada. They lived on an Indian reservation. They were in Ecuador. They traveled they were constantly on the run, constantly trying to remain hidden from really the FBI. So that the children would not be returned to the father who had beaten her and abused the children. And in the end, the Dutch government granted Holly and the children safety and asylum because they heard the same evidence that the judges in America heard, but they believed that Holly and her children would not be safe if she were returned to the United States, and so they protected her. And it is that story of this amazing and brave woman who did everything in her power to protect her children.
You just said it. This, what an incredibly brave woman. When we're talking about this, giving children hope, The mission of this show is that we cover these topics. We cover the extent of the child abuse and the level of violence happening within the walls of our courts, and how you know, severe forms of child abuse are being purposely ignored, and that the abusive parent is getting sole custody of the child, and even following a horrendous violence such as the her son's fractured skull, and that this is a failure within our system, and it's actually a level of organized crime. So what we've done with the Giving Children Hope show is we use this as a way to reach out to all of the children that are trapped in this. Children, to let them know that, you know, people are fighting for them and screaming for them, and that, you know, we're not going to stop. You know, there are many, many parents like Holly Collins, God bless her heart, for, you know, just basically putting her life on the line for the sake of her children. And God bless the Dutch government. Minnesota is one of the hot spots, I can tell you that. Myself, I've met many parents in Dakota County, Minnesota alone, you know, where there's a couple of judges there that are purposely ignoring evidence and leaving children in very dangerous situations. I guess, Garland, what I want to ask you, you know, if there's any children out there listening, you know, I try to form my questions as how children would. How did you learn about this? Like, children who are stuck in this, you know, they're looking for ways out, like the parents. Like the protective parents are, we're trying to find that, you know, that edge, like what's going to give.
Right.
So, you know, as a kind of think, you know, what would children say to you? How did you learn about this, and what inspired you to want to do this and create such an incredible documentary?
Well, first of all, thank you for those kind words. And it's interesting that you would ask that question, because the real motivation for making the documentary was when I heard Jennifer Collins, Holly's daughter, speak at the Battered Mothers Custody Conference in Albany, New York. Gosh, it was probably 2008. And Jennifer Collins has since gone on to become the director of something called the Courageous Kids Network. And if you go online, it's under courageouskids.net, I think, which is an organization by and for children who are victims of abuse, and a way for them both to get help and to share their stories. Because what Jennifer was speaking about at this particular conference was her own sense of powerlessness when the courts gave custody of her and her brother to her father, who had beaten them. But it was also a story about the systematic injustice that occurs in the family courts. I think that's one of the things that shocks most people, is people in America want to believe that the courts are good and the courts are for the protection of the people, and certainly for the protection of children. And, you know, we believe in God and America and apple pie, and the idea that part of our system of justice would actually give children to people who hurt them flies in the face of reason for most people. It just doesn't even make sense.
Exactly.
And that's one of the things that has got to be hard for children. The other thing we know about children is, you know, everything that we teach children about abuse, whether physical or sexual abuse, is if you're being abused, tell somebody. If this is happening to you, tell somebody, tell your teacher, tell a family friend. And in the family court system, if a child does that, the child becomes immediately more endangered than he or she was before. Yes. Because the way the system operates is that it is designed to protect the people who hurt people, not the people who are the victims. And I just really believe that if most Americans knew about this, they would be incensed, they would be outraged, because people want their system of justice to be just. So anyway, I got a little off track there with Jennifer, but Jennifer is the one who was the powerful speaker who told about how her mother was her hero. Her mother was the one who kidnapped them. And of course, when we use the word kidnapped, okay, Holly said, "I'm here to help you. I want to protect you. If you come with me, I will protect you from your dad." And the children chose, they begged their mother to take them, and they chose to go with mother. So the use of the word kidnapping in this particular case is what the court said she did. But the children would say they went with their mother, who was their hero.
That's right. She saved their life. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the children, who are now, I think they're 26 and 29, they absolutely call their mother their hero.
Yes.
And they remain deeply grateful. But there are a lot of mothers or protective parents. Sometimes it's the father. Most of the time it's the mother. But there are a lot of parents who either don't have, just can't figure out how to get out of the country. Also, this was before 9/11.
Exactly.
So I don't think Holly could have gone on the run the way she did right now. I mean, I think once 9/11 happened, security made it so that that was very, very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I just, with this documentary, in this documentary that I had asked you this question earlier, and I definitely want to talk about this, you have a co-producer who helped you with this.
Yeah.
An amazing person that I want. Would you please share him with us and tell everybody
yes,
who he is?
Yes. My husband, Barry Nolan, is the co-producer on this project, and many people may recognize his name. They might have seen him on Hard Copy many years ago. Some people from New England might remember him from Evening Magazine. He's a wonderful, wonderful reporter and writer and thinker, and some people have probably heard him on NPR's radio show, Says You, but he absolutely was an equal partner in this, in getting it off the ground. At one point, we completely ran out of money, and he was the one that organized the Kickstarter project, so we got enough money. Without his doing the Kickstarter, we would not have been able to financially finish the project. So he has been a wonderful husband and a wonderful father to his children and to mine, and I am deeply indebted to him for the work that he did in making, and working as an equal partner and a shared, respectful partner in this process. Because producing a documentary is very time-consuming and it's not easy, and it's stressful, and sometimes people aren't always polite. you can be tired, and your hair's dirty, and you're frustrated, and the edit machine isn't working, and there's all kinds of stuff like that. And he was just a wonderful person and co-writer and co-thinker. So he's a good man.
Yes, he definitely sounds like it, and he just has an incredible heart. Please, let him know. I thank him, Tanis, I'm sure, all of us, because his incredible heart helped put this together, and you two make an awesome tag team. This documentary, No Way Out But One, which people can find on www.nowayoutbutone.com, you guys won multiple awards tag teaming on there.
We were very blessed. We feel very lucky, very fortunate. It aired at one time on the Documentary Channel. And, you can buy it on Amazon.com right now. So we're really both continuing to work to get the word out about this issue. You know, one of the things that sometimes happens when either we speak or when we talk about this is sometimes fathers' rights group people get very angry, and it makes a big difference to have the co-producer be a man who loves his children, who worked hard, and, you know, because it's about protecting children. It's about,
yes,
and it's what you all are doing. But that's our commitment, too, is to saving these children. Because, you know, we learn that when children are not protected, all kinds of problems happen. You know, there's a risk for further abuse. There's risk of so many problems. And, you know, you can understand when children run into trouble when they're not protected by the people who ought to be protecting them.
Exactly.
And I can't imagine anything worse than being a child and seeing a loving parent trying to protect you and watching that parent not be able to protect you in the courts. I just can't imagine what that must be like for a child. So, you know, we all as a nation have to begin to shine a light on the family courts. I mean, one of the other problems is most people don't know about this. Most people have never been inside a family court. And, you know, the truth is, most of the time, these custody cases do not go to family court. Most of the time in divorce, even if people hate each other, they try to work things out so that they do what's best for the children. The cases that end up in family court are almost always the ones that involve abuse of some kind, or domestic
right.
violence, or the technical term that I've heard used, but some people say you shouldn't use it anymore, is high conflict. They're the cases that can't be resolved either through mediation or through negotiation with another partner, and it's about people who fight for what they want, not fight for what is best for the children. And
exactly.
That's a big difference.
Exactly. It's the cases, what separates them is the level of criminality in it. There's child abuse and domestic violence. Those are both against the law, and they both belong in our criminal courts. That's the difference between the parents that can get along and have a decent, subtle divorce where they don't traumatize and torture their children versus the abusive
right.
criminal parent, you know, forcing the protective, loving parent to have to go through extreme great lengths to try to protect the children at that point.
Right.
I want to, talking about great lengths, Garland, you and your husband, you both have a heart of gold. Would you please share with all of us what you guys went through in the actual production and making of No Way Out But One? And I don't know if this was accurate, but if it was, if you could touch on it. I read somewhere that you guys even got to the point where I think you only had like an amount of like $40,000 to even make this with, and you even asked students to help just so you could still get the production done.
Sure. Well, we made this. I mean, let me just put it in a little bit in perspective. Most even low-budget documentaries that are made today cost about $150,000. Michael Moore documentary might cost several million. The big fancy documentaries that do well on HBO or are promoted, most of those are multi-million dollar project. Ours was made on a slim dime. And in the beginning, the woman who became the co-executive producer, Toby Kleinman, who's an extraordinary attorney, and I were talking, and she was the one who said, "Well, Garland, you know, if you could do anything, what would you do right now?" And I said, "Oh, if I had a little bit of money, I'm sure I'd try to do the Holly Collins story, because I think that's a story that has a beginning, middle, and end.
Yes.
She saved her children. There was a happy ending." And, you know, so many of these stories are not happy endings. And the rules of the television business are ones where if you don't have a happy ending, or something that's a payoff, people just can't bear to watch it most of the time. Managed through, she was able to raise a very small amount of money. And with that amount of money, I was able to go to people that Barry and I had worked with in the business. The photographer, Sid Levin, donated his services for free. So we went to Amsterdam. I just paid for his airfare and his meals, but he's a fabulous photographer and has his own production company, and he worked for free. I had an ex-student, a graduate student, who we paid for her expenses to go over, and she went over there with us. Everybody, all along the way, whenever we ran out of money, we would go to our friends in the business and say, can you help us out a little bit here? And when you told them the story about loving parents trying to protect their children from abuse, they all said, sign me up. How can I help? And it was really an extraordinary story, just that alone.
Yes.
The other thing that I did was I had a remarkable graduate student at Boston University who edited the entire program, the entire documentary. And then after she edited that, her name, she edited the entire documentary. And then when we found it was going to air on the documentary channel, we had to bring in a professional production team. But that was why we had to do Kickstarter. And so we got enough money to pay for, but even the post-production company gave us a deal. And the person who did the sound sweetening gave us a deal. And the person who did the original music gave us a deal. Everybody who heard this said, we just want to be part of the change. So it's an extraordinary story to me. It really, really is.
Oh, this is incredible. It's like an act of God, so many people coming together, with huge hearts and just love, unbelievable love for children, and just willing to do anything that it took, to get this done. This is beautiful.
It really was an extraordinary story that way, yes. The photographer, by the way, was Erica Street. And, she was the graduate student at Boston University. And, she, in the beginning, she did it just to do it, to get experience. And then in the end, I was able to pay her a little bit of money so that she, she needed to earn a living. She was trying to go to graduate school. So, and God bless her, So these people just really, really think through and such an amazing way.
Oh, just so amazing how all of this came about. My goodness. Yeah, I was reading that and I couldn't believe it. In this article, really, it was a couple of paragraphs, and it tried to give a description of the production, what you guys went through. And I just, from the little description, I was like, wow, you just said, we're going to do this and we're going to be a voice for all of the children caught in this.
Yeah, I think at a certain point, there's no turning back. I don't know. Sometimes I think I was out of my mind. But, again, Barry, when I started to lose hope, Barry said, no, we can do this. We can do that. Here's what we'll do. And so, and I have a friend in New York, Susan Levitt, who's a magnificent producer who just, volunteered to help, take a look at the scripts and make suggestions about writing things. It's just been an amazing thing to see how many people actively care.
Exactly. Because this, as doing your research with Holly Collins' case, knowing that she had to leave everybody, her family, her friends, her community, and run and be on the run, that is the life of, a parent trying to protect their children from our family courts, basically. I think Hold on 1 second. To calm down here. I'm sorry. I apologize, everybody.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay.
I think somebody's out there plowing. But anyway, this documentary really showed that, you know, did you get to that desperate point that it feels like there's no way out, but one. And you gave them a voice. All of you worked together to give all of our children.
I think you're so right, and you know that you even just hearing you say no way out but one, and hearing that come back again, I really believe that all the people, there's one man that I've met that has really been involved with this kind of work, but most of the people that I've met have been women, and everybody has really tried to work within the system. Nobody wants to run. Nobody wants to, you know, they don't want to leave their families. They don't want to leave their children. They don't want to upend everything. They are doing the best they can. They sell everything they've got. They lose their homes. They lose their jobs. They do anything they can to protect their kids. And by the time they do run, if they're lucky enough, really, to be able to run, it is no way out but one. It is feeling that there no other doors are open. There is no other way to protect their children. But nobody would do this as a first effort. They all stay and try to deal in the courts. They all do. Nobody just says, well, this isn't working out for me. I think I'm going to take the kids and run. It is absolutely the last option.
Exactly, but it's also the option that every parent gets forced to, because you will not get any resolution. Although I've not met a parent, as you said, and even myself included, that has not gone through every length possible in our custody court. Or even criminal.
Yeah.
I've tried with the DA. I've tried political. I've gone to Washington, D.C. and protested and marched and rallied outside the White House and in the Capitol and talked to Congress and everything.
That's really, really important work. You know, we need those people in Washington to be paying attention to this. And, you know, that is so central. So when you go there to make your voice heard and you protest in front of the White House, you know, sometimes it feels like nobody's listening, but little by little, they're going to have to. They're just going to have to. And I also want to say, I'm not an advocate, and I am not a psychologist, and I am not a lawyer, and I would never tell anybody to kidnap their kids and run, ever. I can only say that I understand when somebody does that.
Exactly. Well, and that's the point of this documentary, in my mind, is that a parent is forced to even consider that because our system and our courts fail our children. You know, it's not necessarily mm-hmm. that we're advocating for anybody to, you know, take their children and run. Although every one of us gets to that point. But it's the point
sure.
of it. It's the point that what do we have to protect them if our courts are this level of corruption fails them and leaves them in danger.
I do think sometimes the courts are corrupt. Mostly, I think it's ignorance. I think a lot of judges have heard about something called parental alienation, which is 100% junk science, not 99%, 100%. I interviewed Richard Gardner, the father of parental alienation syndrome, in, I think it was 2001. He stabbed himself to death in 2003. But I got what some people think is the last interview with him, and it was in my first documentary called Small Justice, Little Justice in America's Family Courts. And he actually said on camera, when I asked him about his research, he said, you know, it's anecdotal. I just talk to people. Well, That's not how you get research. That's how you just making stuff up. So but judges are taught that this is legitimate theory. You know, the American Psychological Association has rejected this as theory. It is garbage. But so you've got some judges and social workers and CASA workers who think, oh, well, when a woman says something bad about her ex-husband, she's just trying to get custody of the kids. Instead of, you know, if a woman is bringing up allegations of sexual abuse or child physical abuse, you know, maybe we need to listen to this and look and see if there's any medical evidence to back that up, or see if these accusations are made in good faith. And statistically, 97% of accusations of abuse are made in good faith, which means there is some evidence to support that this is legitimate. But you know, so 3% of people who say he did this to my children, 3% are making it up. 97% are not. But you have judges who believe that. You have judges who are not educated about domestic violence. They are not educated about how a child might say one thing one day and change the next, especially if the abuser is in the courtroom. You know, the child is not going to say, my father did this to me, if the father is standing there watching them. You know, so why don't the courts understand this? So these are things that are really important for people to begin to consider.
Right, exactly.
That's very true.
How prevalent this is.
Yeah, and just to confirm that, the research institute, I'd have to look it up, but they said all the literature all points to actually when a child discloses sexual abuse, that 96% of the time there's abuse that's happened. So that kind of goes along with it's exactly the same figure. And I would like to qualify that. You've said it very, very well, Garland, very understanding, very compassionately about children in these situations. But it's very important for people to know that when the women are making the allegations, they're actually not making allegations. And that's how it's always presented. The mother made false allegations or whatever. But what it is the mothers in these cases are reporting verbatim the statements the children made, and the statements point to abuse. Like a child, 3 and 4 years of age, never says, my dad sexually abused me. They actually say things that constitute sexual abuse. And that's where, you know, the concern is. And so the mother in these situations has the duty to report, the responsibility. And that's what she does. And then more and more it's coming out. We had Karen Anderson on a few weeks ago on the show, and she said 7%, only 7% of those disclosures by the children are substantiated. So there we've got the suspicion in these cases, by CFS, CPS, right? So that's a very low substantiation rate. I heard from somebody else recently that's in the know. When these people are speaking about figures, they're basing it on research. They said 10% of the disclosures made by children to Child Protective Services are substantiated. So we've got a real disconnect here. The reality is when children disclose any type of abuse, sexual is the hardest to find evidence of, because a lot of it is grooming when they're younger. There isn't necessarily medical evidence. So they're being treated with suspicion. The mothers are being discounted. The parental alienation argument is a wonderful, it's a perfect cover-up. It's a perfect part of a formula that is able to use to deflect responsibility from the identified abuser or perpetrator and put it on the mother. And I think it was very interesting to hear that you had interviewed Richard Gardner. Did he say any of the things that many people have read since, that he was pro-pedophilia or believed that it was normal for adults.
He didn't say that on camera to me, but we put in the documentary a quote. We found literature where he had said, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was basically, every culture has a little bit of pedophilia in it. It was sort of a dismissive thing, but what you're saying is just absolutely right, I agree with it. I don't want to pretend to be the expert on these things, but I couldn't agree with you more about what you've said and how you phrased it and what some of these problems are. You know, one thing that did happen, though, when I interviewed Richard Gardner was I said, what's a good mother to do if a child comes to her and says, reveals abuse, and the mother ignores it, the child continues to be abused, and if she acts on it, she could lose custody of her child. You know, if she reports it in court, she could lose custody of her child. What's a good mother to do if her child comes to her and tells of abuse at the hands of the father? And he said, what's a good mother to do? She should beat that child and say, don't ever talk that way again about your father. And that's in the documentary. That's on
here. Wow. What was the name of the documentary again for the listeners? Because everybody needs to look this up. We need to start using this material because that's what this entire system has been based on, because the judges are and the court collaterals are being trained purposely in parental alienation to look for it instead of the money that's going toward training judges, because this is all tax dollars that goes toward training judges and court collateral people. They are probably getting paid while they're sitting in those training days, and what those training days are on parental alienation and not on domestic and child abuse, where the judges should be trained to look for patterns of abuse, characteristics, signs, symptoms, behaviors, so when they're listening to the evidence or looking at the evidence, they are, if it's going to stay in family court and they're not going to put it in criminal court, they have a responsibility to these children to be trained. I was saying, I'm a therapist, Donna's a therapist, I spent so many hours training myself, just like you in your experience have worked for hours for nothing. These people are getting paid in Canada here. They're getting paid between $250,000 and $350,000 a year. You would think they would take it upon themselves then to train themselves. It doesn't take that much reading to make themselves aware of the dynamics of domestic abuse, patterns, characteristics, signs, symptoms in children, in adult relationships. This is abhorrent, actually. And to continue to, while they continue to be immune from decisions they make that not only risk lives, that completely endanger children, leading to their deaths when that wasn't necessary, or such trauma and damage that lasts a lifetime. There is no excuse for this anymore. I mean, people like you have been making them aware. Barry Goldstein has been making them aware. There's all kinds of research out. There's 20 years of documented evidence. There's absolutely no excuse for these judges to continue to play naive. Like, then get the books, get the books that the current research, I mean, spend some time on the weekend. When they get paid $300,000 a year, they should use some of their own time to then get trained. I spent so much time reading in clinical books and therapy, when I was just paid by the hour as a contract counselor, because I was busy having children and mostly being a stay-at-home mom. So that's sort of my take on it. I think
I wish they would take some initiative and do it on their own. But even if they don't do it on their own, the education, the judicial education and the legal education seminars should be, you know, there should be no appearance whatsoever, for instance, of parental alienation syndrome, and they should not be able to get court credit or educational credit for some of these crazy things that are wrong. And you're right, tax dollars go to these, to educate these people, and if they're being educated in things that are actually dangerous to children, you got to ask yourself why that's happening.
That's right. Exactly. Why is that? Why are they, I mean, this has been a very convenient theory to get away with children being put in, especially in situations where they've disclosed sexual abuse, to be put at risk on an ongoing basis because nobody will help them afterwards. And I just want to go back to one of the things you said earlier on, Garland, about the, you know, the language of kidnapping, and you qualified that, but that is how mothers that do try to get away are labeled, just like they are labeled with the same language that an abuser who wants to maintain complete control, who flees to keep complete control, or a stranger who is a kidnapping or abducting a child to harm them, to rape them, to murder them, or whatever. This is ridiculous that the same language is being used. And that's where it's, you know, language is so important to dissect, just like high conflict, because that's been used, you know, gender neutralizing. It's also been used to neutralize the reality of abuse, that there's an abuser and a victim in many of these situations. And so we have to work at really deconstructing that. And I do think it's very powerful for media to do that, like documentaries to, I think actually that is, and these type of shows to deconstruct what's happening and look at it and talk about it and have conversations about it. We may not have solutions, but it's really about highlighting what has been just glossed over, like words, high conflict, divorce, and kidnapping. In fact, I am one of the mothers who I'm now facing criminal conviction for someone saying I could abduct my children, who are now actually, my oldest is almost 18. He's 6'4". I'm not even sure how that would be possible, but I'm still being held under this punitive regime, not only of supervised visits, but of an additional criminal, first of all, being arrested and charged, and now facing criminal conviction because I saw my youngest son, who's almost 12, who wants to see me, who's desperate, he misses me. Someone saw us and reported this, and the police went forward and arrested me. I turned myself in because the only way I could continue seeing my children for supervised visits was to deal with it, as they call it, arrest warrant. And then there was a hearing, and now there's the Manitoba government here is going ahead with prosecuting me criminally for, as they call it, disobeying a court order. What they gave no remedy. They've never given me my children back, even though I, like Donna, have went right to the top of every possible legal, legal avenue to be reunited with my children, who I've been kept away from for 5 years now, since 2009. So three appeals, a motion to vary, an application to the Supreme Court, and at every level they've refused remedy to give my son their mother back. And now I'm being criminally convicted by this province. The DA is called the Crown Attorney, because I could, you know, this has been held over me for another 2.5 years because I could abduct my children, they say, based on. So women have absolutely, not only is there no way out, but one, now we're just absolutely trapped. Because between the technology, just forget it. You couldn't leave the city limits or anywhere and actually not be found. And women get hunted down in a way like never before, when they've never done anything wrong. And now, even based on someone saying, I could. That's where things are at in this day and age.
I think that's a really scary story. I think the idea that somebody saying, you know, well, she could do that.
Yep.
That is very scary. You know, one of the things that has almost saddened me over the years is that I hear so many of these stories. And when I first started doing this work, I was in this state of perpetual rage at the system, at the people, at the injustice. And then I worked and did documentaries, but there's so many stories that are, you know, like that. The names are different, the number of children are different, but they're just so many stories. Where there was one of Crystal Stryloff, who was in Chicago. Her kids, I think, were in public schools, and I'm not 100% sure. I get the details of the story a little mixed up. But she was in jail. They arrested her, put her in jail on a $25 million bond. That was more than OJ's bond was, $25 million. And they said she had kidnapped her children. And they were in public school in Chicago or near Chicago or something like that. But there's story after story. You know, I remember going to one of the battered mother custody conferences in Washington, D.C., and was protesting in front of the White House. And I met these several young women who were there to speak. And they were lovely young women whose children had been murdered on unsupervised visitation despite their pleas to the judge. Please protect my children. So the stories are beyond the pale to me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing too, you know, one of you, I forget which one, said, you know, was talking about sexual abuse and how can this be that the judges ignore so much of this evidence? And there was a lawyer who's also an author, Andrew Vax, mm-hmm. who said, you know, pedophiles have learned to grow their own victims. That if you rape a child who's a stranger, you will go to jail. But if you rape your own child, you can get custody of the child. You know, so this idea that you can grow who you want to hurt or harm should send chills down the spine of every single person who cares about justice or children, because it's terrifying where things stand right now. I thought that expression was bone chilling.
It is bone chilling.
Yes. And I like the way you put it, perpetual rage, because that's exactly it. I mean, for people to hear these stories and not be outraged at what our children are being put through because of the inactions and failures of adults all around them, in every level, every form, you know.
I would like to believe that people aren't enraged because they don't know.
Exactly.
And it's one of the reasons why we have to turn not to mainstream media, because I don't have any faith at all in the mainstream media to deliver the message of truth about this issue. You know, the mainstream media cares about ratings.
Yes.
Any time you want to cover a story like that, they will say, well, we have to talk to the batterer, or we have to talk to the person who's been accused. Well, what is the person going to say? Yeah, sure, I beat everybody up. No, the person is going to say, well, I didn't do it, and she's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and if they don't interview, if the victim of domestic violence says, well, I don't want you to talk to my ex-husband or my boyfriend or whoever it was, the story will go away. They won't do the story because they say the media says, well, we need to get both sides of the story. But, you know, both sides of the story is, if not interviewing somebody who beats people up. You know, both sides of the story is really why judges would give custody to somebody who was an abuser. It's just a little different.
Well, right. This is where the parental alienation argument is so conveniently used, right? It is used purposely and deliberately by the attorneys, and the judges buy it. They eat it like candy. If they are not informed after 20 years of this being used, then they are accepting it mindlessly, which makes them actually incompetent. And so that parental alienation argument is used to say any child that resists going with someone that they're afraid of for good reason because of abuse, no child wants to be with someone that abuses them, just like an adult. Children are, in a way, instinctual. We can compare them a bit to animals, like a dog or a cat that doesn't talk. We'll shy away from someone that's kicked them. And so why we can't understand that a child is afraid of somebody and resists seeing them. And so if they have a safe parent and a safe home, they don't want to go where they're abused. So they fight going. And then this lovely parental alienation argument is used as like the trump card to just nullify a child's, you know, fears and honest, you know, their expressions. They some of them can't articulate that well what's happened, but they are able to say enough that it's quite clear. It would be quite clear to any adult, whether they're trained in this or not, that whatever they're saying is abuse, right? And children as young as three are able to describe things that are clearly abuse. They describe it in a childlike language, and they are very credible. So, yeah, the child resists going. They're afraid. And then the abuser gets to say, parental alienation, you know, she's parental alienated me. The father gets to say that in these cases, and it's a perfect part of this formula to discredit women and be able to, you know, flip the, say she's crazy for believing the child as if there's no abuse. We know actually a statistic I pulled up recently, there are a million, there are millions of digital images. So millions of digital crime scenes of evidence of child pornography. There's over a million children just primarily from the United States alone that are being used, that they have not found, that are being used to produce child pornography with. This evidence exists. So to continue to say, no, there's no abuse, you know, when a child says, discloses abuse, there's absolutely no truth to it. There's no evidence of it. There is evidence out there. There are a million children that they're not finding that are being sexually tortured on crime scenes with digital evidence. That's horrifying.
Well, I think it is too, and I think it's one of the reasons that, you know, I'm actually not knowledgeable about this in terms of statistics or being able to talk about it in a truly intelligent way. But I think there's no question that the pornography industry has some influence, because if you can sexually abuse your own children and then put it up on the internet, there's sometimes a financial motivation to do that as well. I'm really not an expert in this area, but I find it one of the things I'm learning about, and one of the things that I find most disturbing and heart, you know, it makes me angry and it breaks my heart. Yep. Because you just can't believe that people would do this to a child. And then to have a court system that doesn't take it seriously or doesn't believe it is just beyond, it's just so awful.
It's unimaginable. Unimaginable pain, horror, and torture for our children caught up in it, you know, our true heroes. Garland, I know you have been very graceful and given us this hour tonight, and we have about 5 minutes left. And I wanted to ask you, is there anything you've been you know, doing this for our children and giving them a voice and produced the documentary with Richard Gardner and then No Way Out But One and others. Is there anything else you're currently involved in now?
somebody, you know, every time I go to a conference, at any one of these conferences, I get so many people coming up to me saying something along the lines of, you know, I wish you could do a documentary on my story. And truly, I wish I could. I really wish I could. But I'm not working on another documentary right now. In fact, one of the things I'm really trying to do is get the word out about this one. You know, it's very hard. It takes so much time to get a documentary completed and then to get it out there and have people see it and to feel like it's really affecting change is there's a whole lot of work that goes into the documentary after the documentary is actually done and edited and all of that. I continue to work with some wonderful organizations like Child Justice that is run by Eileen King and Dr. Joanna Silberg, who works with the Leadership Council, and Kathleen Russell, who heads up the Center for Judicial Excellence. There's some, and Connie Valentine, who's in charge of Courageous Kids. There are really a lot of people who are doing important work, and frankly, I'm just honored and pleased to be working with them. Joan Meyer from George Washington Law School, who heads up DV Leap. You know, I guess I hope and believe that change is going to come sooner rather than later, that we've reached what experts call a tipping point. We're now there. So many of these stories that you just can't keep sweeping them all under the rug. You just can't.
Exactly.
But as for my doing anything else right now, I'm just working to get the word out about the documentary and hoping that organizations will use it to educate people. Because, you know, but I would be grateful for this opportunity to say one more thing. One of the things that I've noticed is one of the problems is this. There are organizations that care about children and child abuse and child sexual abuse, and there are organizations that care about domestic violence and women's issues. And one of the problems is one organization very often doesn't know about the other organization. There's not this communication. Your organization and your work seems to be very focused on both the awareness that domestic violence and child abuse are connected, and family courts affect domestic violence and children. But there are a lot of organizations in this country that focus only on one or the other, and consequently, they don't understand what's going on in the family courts, and that's the work we all have yet to do.
Exactly. It's that raising public awareness. Garland, when my sons were first kidnapped, when I sought protection for them, I came across this documentary. I was trying to find. I felt very isolated. Like, I didn't know, are there other parents out there, and where are they, and how do I find them? Because it's very isolating and it's very silencing when you're caught in this. But I came across your documentary, and that's how I came across you. And I just couldn't believe it, that someone actually put their heart, soul, and time into putting something together to raise public awareness. I cried when I saw this, because this is what it takes. It takes everybody. You said it. You and your husband tag teamed. You had Toby Kleinman. You had Erica Street. You had, you know, everyone that came together for this, to put this together. And this is what it's going to take. It's going to take all of us coming together to to increase public awareness, to bring attention to this, to fight and scream and be a voice for all of our children. I want to tell you, Tanis, and I know she'll agree, and Stephen, we here at Giving Children Hope want to do whatever we can to help get this documentary everywhere, all over. We will actually, maybe this is a good time, right before you go, Garland, for Stephen to mention the different networks that pick up our Giving Children Hope show, and you can kind of get an idea of where we have people listening in.
Okay. That would be wonderful. And I just, I want to thank all of you for this opportunity. Thank you so much. And Stephen, I really am eager to hear what you're going to share.
Well, we're on Truth Broadcast Network, and we're also on People's Internet Radio out of Ireland.
Mm. All right, so we're covering, what are the different places, Stephen? Because we have the UK and Australia as well, that we have people
yeah.
listening in, the United States.
Spain,
South Australia. Africa.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's impressive, and I still really believe that that's the way the word is going to get out. It's not going to be through mainstream media. It's going to be through work like this and this kind of commitment and going about it a different way, finding a different a different way to get the message out, and that's what you all are doing.
That's right. Amen. I know you have to go here in a minute.
I have actually one more question for
yeah.
Garland, if you have another minute, Garland.
I have one more minute, yeah.
One more minute. Is there anything that you would like to share just in terms of, as someone working in this field, producing documentaries, a journalist, that you could suggest for those of us that are living it, trying to do alternative ways of exposing that, like to get the documentary out besides through this, like talks, organizing things, book launches, writing books. I mean, what else do you think would work? You'd have that sort of idea, that take on it to expose this.
Well, one thing, I think we all have to work with local and national organizations that we know are sensitive to this particular issue. One thing I do think that locally, newspapers, not nationally, because I think, again, the national news is not going to be responsive to this, but on a local level, I think one of the things that sometimes happens is when reporters can understand this link between domestic violence and child abuse and what's going on in the family courts. Sometimes, if you keep the message simple, one of the things, my husband says, well, to me sometimes when I want to give too many details about something, he says, you know, you can't begin with first there were the dinosaurs. You've got to really get right to the heart of the story. You've got to practice your pitch almost when you're talking to people either on the radio or if you're asking a newspaper reporter to consider something. You've really got to keep things pretty simple so they understand it. I think that's real important. The other thing I think is a little manipulative, I suppose, in some way. But, you know, if reporters understood that if they really got the heart and soul and guts of these stories, they'd be winning Pulitzers.
Mm.
You know, there's something in it for the reporter, too. It's not just do-gooding. There's
mm-hmm.
a chance that they can get something out of it. And I hate to be sort of hard and cold like that, but I've really thrown up my hands in despair about getting the mainstream media to do something. So my what I've come back to is we have to change the messaging. We have to keep it simple. We have to keep it direct. We have to make sure that there's a beginning, middle, and end in what we say to people. When a reporter asks for material, we give them a couple of pages, not a book.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's kind of what I think. And I think it's hard because these stories are complicated. But I think we're going to have to keep it simple in order for the greater story to be told. Yes.
Do you think there's value in women writing their own books? Like, because there's free publications now where women can get the word out and increase the volume on this and amplify how pervasive and big the magnitude of this issue. Do you think there's value to that? And then I'll let you go. I won't ask you anything else, but it's been great having you.
No, I'm waving to them that I'm going to be a little late. I don't think books are the answer. And the reason why I don't think books are the answer is I don't think people are reading very many books. I think blogs might be interesting. I think magazine articles might be interesting. I think shorter is better because people aren't, you know, our own personal stories are long and complicated. Mm-hmm. But when one of the things I have said to people when I lecture is, every woman who tells her story must put it in the context of the national story. That the biggest problem is each woman who has a story thinks her story is the worst. And for that woman, her story is the worst. Mm-hmm. There's no question of that because the stories are terrible. They're truly awful, horrible, ghastly stories. But unless the story can be put in the context of a national scandal, a national problem, that this is happening in every single state in America and around the world, unless it's put in that context, I don't know how we're going to get it out. But I don't think a book is the answer. I think possibly short videos on YouTube, like 2 or 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. But short is better, and I think it's always got to be put in the in a national context, and with luck, one national statistic. I mean, if many people wrote stories, short stories, or magazine articles, or blogs, or short videos, and had one or two major statistics in it to prove the point, that would be huge.
Okay,
that would be
good. When you say blog and magazine articles, do you find that there's forms that are more that are better? I just heard of something like I can't remember what it's called, but would you recommend going to a certain site to do an article, a magazine article?
I would go any place that would let me put it.
Yeah, okay, just write it and just do it. Let's get the blog up and... Yeah.
Just do the best you can. And, you know, even some people are doing it just with their Facebook pages. They've got beautiful, impressive, relevant Facebook pages. But I just think people aren't reading books, and a lot of people aren't watching long documentaries. So that's where you're going to get the depth. But in the beginning, you just got to get the story out there to anybody who will listen. And that's why I think, you know, locally... Sometimes local papers are happy to have an op-ed piece or something short. It's about changing the national conversation. I don't think books are the answer right now.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for giving me this opportunity. It was lovely to talk to each of you, and I'm very grateful for the work that you're doing.
Well,
thanks,
Garland.
Thank
we are too. For
yes,
you.
Garland, thank you for coming on the show tonight, the Giving Children Hope show. And please give your husband a big hug from us for all he's done with you on getting this documentary produced and just the awards and everything. Everyone that's helped, Erica Street, Toby Kleiman, everybody. Jennifer Collins, just an amazing, amazing person. Holly, her mother, of course, the true hero, like all of our children. So thank you for coming on this show tonight with us and spending this time with us.
Thank you so much. Good night to you all.
Good night, Garland.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Garland Waller. You can find the No Way Out But One documentary at www.nowayoutbutone.com. You can find that on the internet, www.nowayoutbutone.com. And Stephen, do you want to take a short break at this point?
Yes, I can. But as I said, we have to mute because this is a YouTube video.
Okay, thank you. We'll be back in a few minutes. Amen. And
amen. Good night,
you,
all.
Steven. Good night, Tannis. Good night, everyone out there. And Matthew and Donovan, I love you with all my heart. And my father, happy birthday, Dad. May you rest in peace. It's age 69 at 12:01 tonight, March 14th. I dedicate this show to you. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Stephen.
Good night, everyone.
All right. Thank you, ladies.
Bye-bye.